Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, what growing a man bun taught leadership coach Paul Scanlon about living more authentically. I'll be talking financial well-being with Nick Sherilambus. And how many Irish people could be living with chronic illness COPD and not know it? So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, that was a heavy week, wasn't it? Talk about having the weight of the world on our shoulders. And obviously there have been world issues playing out here in our own country. And we've been watching war in Ukraine and Gaza. And I think many of us perhaps saw the US election as an opportunity of a new world order. There was a lot of sadness and despondence at the result, which seems to put profit before people. But what I will say is hope still remains. I did actually like the post from Kamala Harris with the adage, only when it's dark enough can you see the brightest stars. And as much as democracy has to be respected and the majority has spoken, for those of us who hold perhaps different ideals, the journey may just take longer than expected. And I was part of an event recently with VIP magazine, and editor Bianca Likes had asked me to consider some questions ahead of our interview on stage. And one of them was words that I live by. And I went with that I try to see the good in everything. And she teased me a little bit on stage about it, and we talked about it, and I've been reflecting on it since. And you know what? I stand by it. While there is so much pain and suffering, I've seen it with people close to me and people far and wide. I have also witnessed incredible support and love come forward in those times. And I truly believe that there is more good than bad in this world. Now is not the time to back off and to give up. It serves no one. I spoke to my sister, who actually lives in America, the day of the result, and she seemed to have the same attitude as me. So it must have come from some way we were raised. I mean, I promise you, there weren't rallying PMA talks across the breakfast table, but seeing the good in every situation and remaining hopeful is an attribute I'm actually quite proud to have. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, financial stress is one of the biggest causes of stress and anxiety for people in Ireland, according to recent results from Laya Healthcare. Nick Sherilambus is Managing Director of Alpha Wealth, and he joins me in studio now. Well, Nick, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Claire.
And people will think, wealth, that is so far away from where I am. But we should be making our money work for us rather than us work for our money, right?
Absolutely. And I think there's something that we can all do to improve our financial position. And I appreciate that there are probably people who would be listening to this that may be in a difficult position, perhaps dealing with debt. I'm in a blended family with four children at varying ages from 19 down to 10. And there are a lot of, you know, financial expenses that go with that. But the key thing I suggest, and this is, comes around to the whole area of financial wellness, is make sure that you've just got some very simple kind of steps in place that can help you in reaching your financial objectives.
So how did you get into this line of work?
So I grew up in London, Claire. I'm from Cyprus originally, hence the unusual surname. And I studied in finance, and I worked in investment banking. Then I met a woman, which is why I moved to Cork, and basically had to reinvent myself. And I started working in a financial advisor role in the banks back in 1999. I'm going to be 51 shortly, so I'm a little bit maybe older than some listeners. But and I worked my way up gradually, dealing with various different individuals of all types, having set up my own business 10 years ago, trying to help people in whatever walks of life they are, just doing better with their money and having a better understanding about the various different, I suppose, things that we can do that can improve our situation.
And as I said in the introduction, there is a lot of fear around money. I mean, there are a lot of people who are struggling to put food on the table, and there are a lot of demands on people. But I think people are aware now that they can take steps to improve their financial well-being. I think we talk about it a little bit more rather than it just being a taboo topic.
Certainly, and I think it's helped with the advent of more information that's available on social media. I think particularly during the kind of the COVID years, and I don't want to bring them up, but people had a bit more time perhaps to kind of reassess their financial position and probably spend a bit more time just looking at their own finances. And whilst I appreciate that there's so much jargon and there's so much information that's out there, sometimes people can kind of almost get caught by this kind of inertia because, you know, there's so much that's maybe involved, they would think. But the key thing I always say to people is there are certain things I mentioned earlier. For example, doing a financial budget once a year, I think, is really important for all of us. It doesn't matter how much money you earn, what financial position you're in. It's just to get a kind of a snapshot of what money is there coming into the household and what money is going out. And just trying to kind of have some sense of the fact that whilst, you know, we all have to pay for certain things like our groceries, our rent or mortgage payments, certain insurances that we have to bear, there are those expenses that are what I term kind of almost like, you know, the lifestyle kind of choices. And what happens is as we go through the years and perhaps hopefully get paid a little bit more, this lifestyle creep comes in where we don't really apply the money that we're earning in the right manner. And again, it's not to try and kind of give out to people or kind of make them feel bad about their situation. It's just saying that, you know, if, for example, let's say based on the recent budget announcement, we're all going to be better off come January by the tune of somewhere between sort of 80 and 100 euros a month. And we were also in the same position last year. And yet many of us didn't really maybe take account of that. And again, we just absorb it into our kind of a day-to-day spending. And what I refer to then is trying to kind of assess like what your financial goals are. So in Alpha Wealth, we always ask people like, what's important to you? Is it that you want to try and get onto the housing ladder? Is it that you're trying to help your children through third level education and beyond? Are you hoping to try and retire early? And helping them then just establish in those three different kind of pots, the right amount that they can apply. And people often say to me about pensions. Pensions are vastly misunderstood in our industry. And the way I would kind of refer to is that the government are trying to encourage more and more people to be a member of a pension scheme, hence the auto-enrollment scheme that's coming into effect in September 2025. This has been on, I suppose, the cards for many, many years now, but it is actually eventually coming into play. And they're trying to, I suppose, incorporate an additional 800,000 people into that sort of pension area. But a lot of people are still unaware of what it actually means and then how to kind of get the most from it.
Because we are living longer and we're living healthier. And, you know, in some instances, we're going to work longer, but maybe that's not for everybody. And to rely just on the state pension is going to significantly impact on people's lifestyle. So it's about that planning for the future.
It is, Claire. And again, going back to those three different pots that I refer to, and I refer them as like short, medium and long term, and helping people just to assess. And people are surprised by how much money they can accumulate over a long period. It's this kind of effect of compounding, you know, your interest grows and continually snowballs. But when it comes to pensions, the way I'd like to, and I don't use the word pensions when I talk to people because it has this kind of connotation, I just refer to a long-term savings plan where you get this kind of tax boost. And if you're earning over the threshold, which from January will be 44,000 a year, the tax man's going to take over 50% of your earnings beyond that. And you really need to kind of think about what you can do to try and mitigate the tax you pay, tax being the biggest expense that we go through in life. And certainly putting money aside for the future, that sort of last third of your life, as you mentioned, you'd be surprised how much money can be accumulated even at a relatively moderate level.
And it's about starting, isn't it? I mean, it's something I've often got from financial well-being interviews that I've done over the years. Often we wait until there is a big windfall or there is a big change in our circumstances before we feel there might be time to start saving. And often those times don't come. But even if we start small with that 10 euro a month, it does then begin to build over time. And then as you get a bigger pot, you might get advice on where to invest that and how to make that grow. But it is just about starting, however small.
Absolutely, Claire. And this, again, comes back to maybe getting some advice, because a lot of people who may, for example, work for a company that offers a pension scheme, I still come across people that aren't contributing to their pension, even at a moderate level. And I refer to this as free money. You know, if you have a company that will allow you to join a pension scheme, but because of sometimes lack of advice, and again, people are not necessarily being given appropriate advice. You know, there was a recent survey about, you know, people's, you know, inability to understand finances. You know, we are kind of, as a nation, there's over 40% of people were referred to as financially illiterate, which is not a word I like, but that's the reality. They don't really understand about the opportunity to put some of their money that they have. And even if it's, as you said, a moderate amount, it can grow and build. And as you get more, it's more the habit. You know, I always say to people when I meet them, what money are you putting into your short-term needs, things that you want to do in the next 3 years? For example, if you want to go on holiday, you should have some form of savings and make sure that it's in an account that is actually earning interest. We all got quite lazy, dare I say, over those years where the banks weren't paying any form of interest. This is from sort of typically 2009 till about 2022. But as interest rates rose, which was hurting mortgage, obviously, payers, the people who had savings were leaving them in these non-interest-bearing accounts. And we've seen recently the likes of Revolut, for example, who kind of were the first to really enter this market. And they've been joined by some more attractive entrants, the likes of Raisin Bank, Trade Republic, Bunk, and so on. And it's more about just understanding that you can have security, but also get interest in your money. And that's the piece that I kind of try and interject to people when I meet them.
What does financial well-being mean to you as a concept?
To me, it's being able to cope with debt. So again, it's acceptable to have debt. Many people I come across do have debt, mostly for a house that they buy. It's very hard to buy a house without taking out a mortgage. And also then other forms of debt, for example, like a car loan. Some people may have taken, you know, home improvement loans and so on. The key thing is just to understand about managing that. So for me, financial well-being is being in control of your finances. What does that mean? Understanding what money you have available to you and what you're spending it on. And then trying to ensure that, you know, you're meeting those financial goals in the future that you have. So, for example, if you're looking to try and get a property, as difficult as it is, you need to recognize what it will endure. Typically, for most of us, it's a 10% deposit that we need to kind of raise. Sometimes there is government supports out there, like the Help to Buy scheme, that can alleviate that. And then really knowing, okay, what my options are and how then I can best apply myself. And I would suggest typically to people that, you know, rather than maybe having this kind of, I suppose, lack of knowledge, rely on someone that can help you. You know, I often, and I had an interview recently with someone that said they don't understand finance. And I say to them, but it's almost akin to like speaking to, you know, a doctor about some ailment you have. You don't necessarily need to understand it. You just have to have confidence in them that they can steer you and get you on the right kind of path. And that's what we talk about when we give financial guidance. I refer to this roadmap and helping people then to understand. And more importantly, is that they check in and review these things quite regularly. Most people we come across haven't had any form of financial review in the last 5 years. And I say to them, but your situation's changed so much, not just for you, but for even the environment around you, you know, as I said. And we've all gone through different stages. I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm in a blended family. I set up a business 10 years ago. I've moved countries. I've changed jobs 3 times. And I've always had a plan. The plan has had to adapt, subject to obviously the situation I found myself. But I'm always trying to apply, you know, what I can in the right ways. A lot of people tend to overpay for their insurances. And I say to them, one of the simplest ways to get money back into your pocket is don't overpay for your insurance. Use a general insurance broker to reduce the costs that you pay on certain insurances that you have to bear. Still, most people are not using the Revenue Online system. That's a really simple tool that we can use to claim back money that we're owed by revenue over the last 4 years. Still, over 50% of people haven't claimed for the rental tax relief credit, which is incredible. You know, it's worth 750 euros or up to that over the last 2 years, and it's been increased from next year onwards. Those people that worked during the COVID years at home and may still continue to do so, we can all claim back up to 30% of certain expenses that we bear at home, and yet many people still haven't done that. And I think part of that is because they don't realize how simple it is. Maybe they're slightly fearful of, you know, bringing revenue onto them. But I've done a tax return in 27 of the last years, and I've been owed money by revenue in 26 of them. And the one time that I owed revenue money, it was about €5. So it's always been in my interest, and I've made and got back thousands upon thousands of euros because of it.
It all comes down to the stories we tell ourselves, isn't it? And we're like, I'm not good with money. I'll never have money. And taking the head out of the sand and just opening your eyes and getting advice can open up many doors and hopefully alleviate some of the stress people might be going through. Where can people find you?
So the easiest way, really, Claire, is online. And there are some really good online tools that, you know, are available to people. So even on our own website, alphawealth.ie, people can access just webinars that we do. They're completely free. They can download them and listen to them at their leisure. We have a podcast channel which people can listen to. And again, we just try and, I suppose, make it more interesting for people. You know, it's probably not the most interesting topic to talk about budgets and, you know, things that we're spending our money on. But the thing is, and someone mentioned to me about, you know, how can you help in terms of, like, you know, because it's not a tangible area, you know, putting money into savings or putting money into your pension scheme, again, word that I don't like using, we can't visibly see and touch it. And therefore it becomes, I suppose, less attractive to us. And what I do is I try and position it and say to people, like, it's about, you know, recognizing that this is a goal that you're trying to achieve, to buy that house, to be able to spend more time with your kids or to, you know, travel more. My own financial plan is that, as I mentioned, I'm going to be 51 shortly. For the next 9 years, I'm building a financial plan for myself that would allow me to spend more time with my wife and travel more. That's a specific goal I have, and I'm working towards that. And I just keep reassessing where I am on that sort of cycle. And sometimes things change, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. But that's really the kind of the main message.
Yeah, having a plan is the key. Well, Nick Sharalambos from Alpha Wealth, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much, Claire. It's a pleasure.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, is thought to affect 380,000 people in Ireland. However, only 110,000 have been diagnosed, so many are walking around unaware. To help spread the word, COPD Support Ireland will be undertaking a nationwide roadshow offering free breathing tests in the lead-up to World COPD Day at the end of the month. I'm joined in studio now by Denise Croke, who was diagnosed in 2014 and is now a health promotion and movement officer, and consultant respiratory physician, Professor Tim McDonnell. We are both very welcome.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
Please.
And Denise, you have a very, very interesting story, because even when I say that you were diagnosed in 2014 and now you're out there promoting movement and health, that encapsulates how you've come through it. But talk to us about the lead up to the diagnosis and what symptoms you were experiencing.
So in early 2014, January, in fact, I developed a cough, and after several rounds of antibiotics and steroids, it still persisted. It wouldn't shift. It would go away for a while and then come back. It was a very violent cough, and I began to lose weight and experience, I can't even call it tiredness, because it's a level past anything that you would recognise as being tired. So I began to experience fatigue that really debilitated and limited my daily life, to the point where if I needed to be somewhere at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I would have to get up at 8, have a shower, have a rest, get dressed, have a rest, and go manage the day. Now, at that stage, I was 10 years younger, physically active, have a healthy lifestyle. I've never smoked, and I only drink when I'm watching Arsenal, because it's the only way to get through a match. So I really, you know, I think there was some part of me that thought, I'm actually making this up in my head, because if there was something wrong with me, someone would have found it by now.
And reading your story for our chat today, you know, I was really struck by the words, and my world became very small, because you do tend to retreat. And, you know, even
those stats I gave of the people that are walking around unaware, you know, there are people who are scared to go and get a diagnosis, who think, I'll just stay the way I am. And yet staying the way you are isn't helpful either, especially if your world is getting smaller.
Yeah, and it wasn't so much, for me, it wasn't so much the diagnosis. And although when you get a diagnosis of a chronic illness, one of the first things it does is to separate you from people who don't have a chronic illness. You're othered in that way. But it was more about learning to manage it in the sense of managing my energy, managing my time. Now, I'd be quite an introverted person anyway, so it's not that I was cutting back on a rampant social life, but even making plans to meet for coffee, making plans to go for lunch, and being too tired to follow through on those things, it got to the stage where I was so embarrassed to be cancelling plans that I wouldn't even make them. And then being afraid to be in crowds during COVID, particularly in case, you know, I caught something, or having this new vigilance about my health that I had had the privilege up until that point of never needing to clue into. Even though I had been unwell with pulmonary sarcoidosis from 2008, it went into remission, and I suppose I got a bit complacent until I was hit with this again, and had to relearn all of those strategies around reframing my mindset. And, you know, but we talk in the, I work with self-management support coordinator in work, and we do a lot of work with COPD support groups and set them up in the area. And one of the things we talk about is that aspect of peer support, because nobody really understands except the people who are living that experience. And one of the things that we all have in common is that we feel incredibly selfish about having this additional impetus to self-care. And we're all quite bad at it. And I've heard you speak about it several times, you know, that we're always the last to mind ourselves, and we don't prioritize it, and we act as if it's a luxury almost rather than a necessity. So it's very hard to say to your family, or to say to your job, or say to your friends, I just can't. And you don't feel like you're holding up your end of the relationship, the work relationship, the marriage, the household. It's that's one of the most difficult things for me, I think.
I want to bring you in, Tim. I mean, as a consultant respiratory physician, you don't underestimate the power of the respiratory system. But I think a lot of us perhaps do. I mean, you hear Denise talking about that fatigue. If you're not getting in enough oxygen through the lungs and into the system, you're not going to be functioning at your best.
Absolutely. I would have sort of said, you know, as a doctor, that the two problems that patients with COPD have are, one, that they get short of breath, and two, that they get what we call exacerbations or infections, which leads to a need to go to your GP or treat yourself, or even go to hospital or get admitted. But what Denise has sort of come over is the sort of secondary effect. If you're short of breath, you're going to get exhausted. It's going to really limit your activities of daily living. And to doctors, that can be very hard to sort of tie down. And a patient like Denise may present to the GP and not really, you know, get a handle on it, because the fatigue is so nonspecific, but the shortness of breath perhaps is a little bit more specific, but it may sneak under the radar. A lot of people who develop COPD, for instance, may think, you know, I'm just getting a little bit older. It's to be expected that I can't climb up the stairs as well as I used to when I was younger. It's only to be expected that I'm not able to chase after my grandkids or whatever. And that it sort of sneaks under a little bit, that shortness of breath. If you are getting short of breath, you really should get yourself checked out. It could be COPD, it could be other causes of lung disease, it could even be heart problems, but do get it checked out. Don't accept it.
And, you know, to take the fear out of it, Denise, I mean, how did you go from that you described to now working in health promotion, giving wellness talks, doing park runs, weightlifting and choir singing? You can come out the other side.
Yeah, absolutely. I won't lie. I had a very difficult period for a number of years where I struggled with mental health, with depression, anxiety, again, because my life had become so contracted. But also, I have a very, very busy brain. And so mindfulness for me is always movement based. I can't sit and meditate. It just creates anxiety in me. And not being able to do that was really, really difficult for me. I could walk maybe my 6 minute walking tests would last 90 seconds and it was like, okay, game over, you know. And that was very, very difficult. But one of the respiratory nurses in NACE Hospital suggested a program called Living Well to me, which at the time was quite a new program. And it was people who were trained facilitators, but who had lived experience of a chronic illness. At least one of the two facilitators was living with a chronic illness. It was a 6 week program and it was tips and strategies around not just managing the condition, but managing your mental health and sort of reframing your mindset around accepting limitations and, you know, learning new ways to be in your body and different expectations of it. And I realized I had been very angry with my body, which sounds a little bit woo-woo, but I'm sure now as a doctor, you'd love me coming into you to say, I'm great today because I have befriended my body. But, you know, you kind of learn new ways to manage yourself. I'm working with what's available
to you rather
than against it.
Even if I get a simple head cold, I'm like, what pillar of wellness have I let down and why have I managed? I know all this stuff. And, you know, getting ill is a very natural and normal part of life. There's a lot of blame and shame around diagnosis. And, you know, that reaction that you had, feeling maybe a burden, feeling your body had let you down. I think it's important that people talk about the emotional side of getting unwell.
Yeah. So, but, you know, and then through the Living Well programme, I was referred to pulmonary rehabilitation, which again is a 12-week program, but it incorporates exercise with a trained exercise practitioner, a respiratory physio and a respiratory nurse. Now, what that did for me was, and it again, it does different things for different people, because people with COPD or respiratory difficulties tend to be inactive because of a fear of breathlessness. And it's very frightening to lose your breath because it's so fundamental. But what that did for me was it gave me back a confidence, because I'd always been active. I'd always been a very physical person. It gave me confidence that I could lose my breath, but I could manage it. And it was done in a very safe and supportive way. So when those 12 weeks were done, I joined a gym, and now to say I was fairly harmless at the beginning would be an understatement. But over time, that my confidence came back, stamina came back, and it was at gym, it was community, and it was those three pillars that really drew me to health promotion in the first place. Coincidentally, it was that physical connection, mental health and social connection. And when those three things come together, you know, it's really, really powerful. And I think it was Martin Luther King who said, when we replace I with we, even illness becomes wellness, you know. And it is that, even if you're not speaking to each other, you're there together, you know, and you have that support if it's the, you know, the grimace of pain. And, you know, and why I started weightlifting again, it's about the busy head. The mechanics of it allow me to be quite mindful in my movements, because if I'm not, the risk of injury is quite, you know, is quite serious. The movements are very complex, even though they happen very quickly. So,
And, you know, no matter what it is, from yoga, you know, bringing you from your head into your body, you know, you always feel better coming back from a walk or even counting reps in a gym. It's very, very mindful. Tim, I mentioned that there is going to be a roadshow with a team of COPD health professionals giving this simple and painless breathing test. Can you give us an idea of what people will go through?
One of the problems with the COPD is that a lot of people have the disease and they don't recognise it and it's not diagnosed for them. The test to diagnose COPD is a thing called spirometry. It's a relatively simple test. Basically, all it is that the patient blows into a tube and their output is measured. Very simple. It doesn't take too long. It does take a little bit of expertise to deliver it, and it hasn't been as available as it should have been in the country in the past. Again, with the HSE's integrated care program being developed under Sláinte Care, they deserve great credit for it. They're rolling it out to a lot of integrated care centres around the country. But with the roadshow, you're going to be able to get information on COPD, what exactly it is, how you can best manage your COPD. But also in some of the sites, you're also going to be able to get spirometry done so that you can get an assessment of your lung function there and then.
Well, I think you're a fantastic ambassador for this campaign, Denise, because, you know, even though it was tough, even though you were having debilitating symptoms and it took a while, you're living with it now, living well. It opened up a whole new world to you, a whole new career path to you. Would you recommend that if people, something is ringing for them listening to this interview, that they get themselves checked and tested?
Absolutely. I think you mentioned the fear of a diagnosis, but I'm a great believer that if you have a name for something, you can understand it. And with that understanding then comes the capacity and the resources to manage it. Before I knew what it was, I couldn't manage it. And now I manage it very well. But that's been a process as well. And one of the things we do quite actively in health promotion is work on this area of health literacy for anybody really, but for people with chronic illness in particular. And it isn't about reading and writing or any, you know, stereotypical conceptions of literacy, but it's about having the confidence to ask questions about your own healthcare, even in a pressurized situation, like a very short consultation time, to be able to say, you know, I don't understand. Can you repeat it? And to acknowledge that in a room with a consultation, there are two experts. You know, there is the medical expert who is the expert on the disease. And then there is you who is the expert on how this disease is in your body. And when that expertise comes together, there are better patient outcomes, better health outcomes for people. So I would say really that my experience of being a patient with COPD has actually been a very positive one. I've been very well cared for. I've been very well supported. And not just in clinical or acute settings. There are, through COPD Support Ireland, there are support groups all over the country. I think there are 42. And you have that peer support, you have that information, you have education, as well as learning to exercise. And just, I suppose, I talk a lot about being in the gym because that's, and I walk a lot. But I would encourage people to do any sort of physical activity that you like, you know, to do it, to enjoy it, and to do it often, because of not just the physical benefits, but also, you know, the mental health.
Yeah, movement benefit is medicine, absolutely, as they say. Yeah. Well, you are fantastic. I'm totally robbing that Martin Luther King quote. It's absolutely brilliant. You have a fantastic way about you. If people want to find out more about COPD, there is an advice line. It's free phone 1-800-832-146. And to find out more about COPD and indeed that road show and the testing that's going on around the country this month, go to COPD.ie. Denise Croke and Professor Tim McDonald, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Paul Scanlon is a professional growth and leadership coach. He was in Ireland recently with an effective communication event and he joins me on the line now. Paul, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you. Thank you.
Paul, tell us a little bit about you and what led you to do what you do.
Well, I do a range of things. You know, I have one of those kind of jobs where you dread someone asking you what you do because it's so complicated what I do. So I suppose I do a range of things now, all of which I suppose are the same thing, which is me helping wake up humans to their authentic self. That's my why of what I do. And then act as a guide to help them come back home to that version of them. I suppose everything I do is doing that, but I do it through communication events, communication masterclasses. I just did one in Dublin recently, through one-on-one mentoring, through group mentoring, leadership coaching. I do a lot of staff training with high-end retail and hotels also around the world. But I'm kind of doing the same thing in all of those spaces. And I've done this for over 40 years now.
And what does it mean to live authentically?
Well, I suppose it means different things to different people, but at least it should mean that what we see is what we get, that we're not dealing with a role or a persona or a mask or a representative self or a title or a status, that we're dealing with the real you. And I think it matters to me to talk about that at this stage of my life because I think we all crave authenticity in our politicians and in the people that are ruling in our communities, in our romantic relationships, people we buy from, trade with, vote for, follow. I think we're looking for them to be them. And this is, by the way, as I think we all know, why people like Donald Trump have become so popular, because, you know, what you see is what you get, whether you like it or don't. what you see is what you get. There's no double talk. You know what he's saying when he answers a question. And I think somehow people are willing to take a risk with that than I suppose the more polished political version, and you're not really sure what you're going to get. I think Ed Sheeran, Adele, all of these people, that authenticity has given them, I think, the huge following that they have.
So are there people then who are living inauthentically? I mean, when you go to that sort of polished idea and that rehearsed role, are there people in everyday life who are living in that way?
Most of us are living inauthentically, but we're unaware of it. I don't think it's intentional. It is intentional for people like politicians and public life people or in the spotlight who are deliberately trying to not say the wrong thing. So they are intentionally not being authentic. That's why sometimes when you get the only time you get an authentic version often of politicians is when they've retired and they're on a chat show. And you think, where the hell was that when you're in office? And they're chatty and they're telling jokes and they're unguarded and they're unfiltered, but they were not like that in the office. So they're intentionally being inauthentic. But most of us are living inauthentic. I was for most of my life or the early part of my life. But you're not aware of that. I think when you're unconscious to who the real you is, which all of us are born and nurtured generally to not be ourselves, in that sense, I mean, that we're not authentically us. And the biggest work of my life has been, I think, to get back home to the authentic version of me, because we're all raised to be someone else's version of us by nature and nurture and culture and environment and context. We're all sort of conditioned to be a certain version of us, which is classically where the whole thing of midlife crisis comes from. People get to midlife and think, wow, I'm not who I've wanted to be. I haven't lived my life. I've lived someone else's life, which has led me into a career I don't want, relationships I don't want, habits and beliefs I don't want. So, yeah, I think most of us are living inauthentic, but we're unaware of it. That's why my role, I think, is to, first of all, wake people up to that idea.
And what was the turning point in your life?
I think it was my probably late teens. I was married. I had three kids by the time I was 20. And I felt stuck and depressed and hopeless and despairing. And it's then somehow in my late teens, early 20s, I had some version of an epiphany, an awakening, an aha moment that I was in fact becoming a repeat of my father, who was a violent alcoholic. And I think my dad, somewhere in his early life, felt stuck and trapped and made bad choices that we all suffered from, downstream of those choices. And I think somewhere in my late teens, early 20s, I had some crossroads moment where I realized I had options to make, and most were very bad. They were default options that I think my dad chose. Or there was a few good options that would, of course, take more work. And I chose better options for my life. I chose to get a job that paid me more money, that could get me and my family out of the poverty that we were in and give me some prospects in my work life and so on and so on, give me some self-determination financially and some options that we didn't have and my family never had. I was the first of my kind in my family, for instance, to ever own a house or own a car, et cetera, et cetera. So I felt I was generationally breaking a conditioning line of humans in our Scanlon line, as it were. And that happened in my late teens, early 20s.
And so does it begin with asking questions to become more conscious? Do we need to become more aware? And does that have to start with questions?
It can start with questions, but I think most of us aren't aware that we need to ask those questions. So I think where it starts for most of us, like it was for me in my late teens, early 20s, was some sense of crisis, some sense of tragedy, dark night of the soul, stuckness. Lots of people experienced an opportunity of this, by the way, in the pandemic, when lots of us lost our roles, titles, status, that were all keeping our false identities intact. When all of those things were ripped from us, I think some people realized this is a space for me to maybe ask some deep questions, and they did. And, you know, as we all know, we laughed about it because social media was full of it. People went to, you know, baking banana bread or fishing or gardening or whatever. But they realized that they were happier doing that and stumbled into that discovery because they had nothing else to do. but learned to keep those things in their life since then, because doing those things made them feel more authentically human, happier, and themselves. So I think sometimes it takes a crisis for us to ask those questions you're suggesting. I don't think we wake up every day and think, ooh, I'm going to ask a question about improving my life. I think we need nudges towards that, often of a negative nature.
You mentioned that you were in Dublin recently for an event, and it was based around effective communication.
Yeah.
So how important is that in everyday life? Because this wasn't just for people giving presentations. This was for everyday life.
Yes, it was called Seven Levels of Authentic Communication. And again, it's my most recent communication event. I'm touring around the world at the moment. I'm in America with it next week. The idea of it is, for me, again, that I think we want authenticity in the voices we listen to, follow, buy from, vote for, are romantically involved with, whatever it may be. We want to have those voices in our lives where we turn to for help and advice and wisdom, to be at least authentic, to have done the work to become authentic, for them to earn the right to be listened to by us. So therefore, I'm speaking in that event in Dublin about these seven levels. Actually, none of them are to do, I suppose, with the act of communication. They're all to do with who you need to become and the work you have to do to be authentic. So the seven levels are about, of course, being yourself, and I explain what I think I mean by that, self-awareness and how that's a superpower in communication, because self-awareness is the gift of an understanding how other people experience you. That's why it's a superpower, because once I know how others experience me, I, of course, can change how I approach people that I want to influence with my voice. It's things like that. It's things like how to discover your why and make sure you're delivering that. It's things like energy doesn't lie. And as a communicator, as a voice, your energy could be saying one thing when your words are saying another. So there's a huge disconnect. You are saying one thing with your language and your content, but you're saying another thing with the energy. And that disconnect is a huge blind spot for most communicators. So the day is about all that, yeah.
What about the people that you met? I'm sure you had a mix of nationalities. Of course, we're all becoming a more inclusive society. But of the Irish people you met, how did you feel the Irish are when it comes to communicating authentically?
Good. I don't find the Irish, I think I find the English more reserved and guarded and difficult to connect with than I think the Irish are. I am part Irish. I have an Irish passport. My grandparents from Limerick. So it's like, you are my people, you guys. So I think the Irish I've found to be conversational, unguarded, chilled, hence the whole, you know, when I got the Irish passport, people said to me, the Irish passport is known as the golden passport. I said, why is that? They said to me, because everybody loves the Irish. Irish are happy. They're not at war with anyone. There's an Irish bar bringing joy and Guinness around the world. Kind of vibe. And that's the reputation of the Irish around the world. It's not a bad reputation to have. And I think that extends to me, to my interactions with Irish people. So the Irish people in the room, and whenever I've been working in Ireland, I find to be like that.
Yeah, there's the energy that you sort of spoke about, isn't there? And no matter what taxi you get into the back of and all the corners of the world, when you say you're Irish, they do share that energy back. There's an excitement that comes with other nationalities too, but it's good that you felt that. A communications expert with ties to Ireland can feel that. What stops us from communicating authentically?
Fear, self-consciousness of what will someone think of me if I really say what I think, or if all my life I've been a people pleaser, and most of us were raised to be that, for instance, if I find my no voice and start to say no where I know I need to stop saying yes, but I mean no, there's going to be implications of that. And so I think showing up today for any person listening to us in what they feel is really who they want to be, saying what they really want to say. And I don't mean, you know, being rude or unkind, though it may come across like that to people. You can't control how people experience you when you've been authentic. So I think fear of what others will think, am I still going to have you as my friend if I say no to you today, who I've always said yes to? am I really going to be accepted in the groups that I've been with if I stay, if I say, look, I've never enjoyed that activity that we do together. I'd rather not involve in that in your friend group. If that feels inauthentic to you to be doing those behaviors, you're scared to say, I don't want to do it anymore because you're afraid of being ostracized from the group. So all of those social pressures to fit in are what stop us risking not fitting in by speaking our truth, being ourselves, as it were, when we know we're not being that. So I think it's fear.
I often find that when you say no to something, when you authentically don't go along with something just for the sake of it, and you do say no, in as you say, not in a rude way, in a gentle way, but you just express, no, that doesn't suit me right now. The couple of times I've done it that stick out in my mind, you almost give other people permission to do the same in their own life. So you think you're going to offend somebody, but actually you see a glimmer of inspiration or fire in their eyes when they watch you say no to something. I've experienced it a couple of times recently. People say, oh, well, good for you. You know, and you can tell they're thinking, why don't I say that a little bit more in my life?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're shining, my shining, anyone shining can inspire others to want to shine. The problem, I think, often with what you're describing here, I get that. And I think that's partly why some of us go on to keep doing what we do. We've discovered that at first it's really difficult, but eventually you start to get some kind of feedback that people were inspired by what you said or did. I think in the initial stages of finding your voice, as it were, of authenticity, people often don't give you that feedback. So you feel very alone in being yourself because people don't thank you for saying no when it's the first thing you begin to do. Initially, it's difficult to show up as yourself. It's quite lonely if no one else around you is trying to do that. You know, I was speaking to the people at the event in Dublin about being yourself. And an example was, I said years ago, I grew my hair long. I stopped coloring it, gave into the gray, grew it long, grew a beard, never had long hair, never had a beard. And I got all kinds of comments from my family and friends about my appearance and wasn't going to cut my hair. I look scruffy and so on and so on. And I thought, no, I like this look. And then one day, God help me, I tied my hair up into a man bun. Then all hell broke loose with the comments, you know, what's this Miami Vice, you drug dealer, homeless look, whatever. And I realized what I was dealing with was their discomfort about me not being their version of me. Once I stepped away from who they wanted me to be, just in appearance now, I started getting this, you know, playful, but actually quite agendered comments that were coming to me. And when I ignored them and pushed through, it got more intense until they realized I wasn't changing. So if you can get that kind of pushback just from changing your hairstyle, what kind of pushback will you get from saying no and really showing up authentically who you want to be in habits of life you want to change, behaviors you want to change, new things you want to do with your life, new energies you want to have for your life, new relationships? All of that is going to get a lot of pushback if you know I'm going to get pushback for simply saying, I want to wear this dress, or I want to go to that event, or I want to eat something different today, or I want to learn a new language, or whatever it may be. To step outside the norms of your world often doesn't get that so inspiring. That often comes later if you can survive the criticism at first. People tell me now, or people say to me now, well, you rock that look. And I'm like, nobody was telling me that years ago.
Before I let you go, Paul, I wanted to briefly touch on longevity because it's an area that you're very interested in, living longer, living healthily. So what is your advice for people? How are you doing it? Because you look in the pink of health.
Yes. Well, I decided, I think in my late 30s, early 40s, when I realized the free ride of youth is over, around 40, I think your body tells you, the free ride of youth is over. I wanted to become intentional to age well. Also, what helped me to commit to age well was I looked at people, I suppose 15, 20 years ahead of me, who were not aging well. And I determined in my early 40s to age well in five areas. I wanted to age well physically, but also mentally and emotionally and relationally and generationally. I have seven grandchildren now, so I wanted also, eight grandchildren, I wanted to pass on to them generationally the benefit of anything I'd learned in my life. So I felt my aging well had to be across a range of areas. I didn't want to look good physically, but be ill on the inside. I didn't want to have a great physical health regime, but have poor emotional hygiene or poor mental hygiene. So I wanted to make sure that my aging well algorithm was across a range of areas that would hand me wellness internally and externally as I got older. I am 67 now. I'm in the best health and shape of my life inside and outside. But I know it's thanks to habits I began in my early 40s.
Well, you certainly sound good. You look good, man bun and all. If people want to find out more about Paul's work, you will find him at paulscanlon.com or on Instagram at paulscanlonuk. Paul, thank you so much for coming on. Hopefully we get to see you the next time you tour around the country here in Ireland.
Thanks, Claire. Thanks for the chat and much love to you all. Thanks for everybody. Take care.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.